91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Okay, so many people would like a career in the outdoors, but most of those require living outside the Bay Area, like in agriculture or forestry. Well, one exception is to be an arborist, a person who plants and trims trees, sometimes very tall trees. They're near, not so far from my house, I saw some guy, really on like a sequoia or some huge 100-foot eucalyptus. Anyway, what's it really like to be an arborist? Well, with me in the studio is somebody for whom money does indeed grow on trees, although it certainly has its ups and downs. Ugh. Anyway, he's Scott Wheeler. He is an arborist and a manager at The Urban Arborist. Scott, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. I thought we were going to leaf the puns out of this.
Oh, you're good.
We'll
you're
run
good.
With it.
I think we need to let me lift your microphone. Just give me a moment here. Listeners, stay with us for just a second. I want to make sure that you get to hear him as well as we should. Okay.
Thank you, sir.
And now. Now I can start to torture you. I mean, ask you questions. So how did you get into tree work to begin with?
I'd like to say that I fell into it. We try to leave that word out of the tree industry. I actually went to college for history and anthropology. I didn't have any designs to get into tree work at all.
Huh.
Came back to the Bay Area. I was born and raised in San Francisco. And I had a side job writing for an Italian soccer team. I had a sort of op-ed piece that
there's
I put
a natural transition. Writing for an Italian soccer team. Tree work, absolutely. You can just immediate transferable skills.
It's a basic career path. I needed to raise a little money to get over to Italy, where I was going to be hosted and follow the team around and write for them. And a friend of a friend was an arborist. He needed somebody on the ground to hold the ropes, drag brush. I was 22, young, dumb. Thought this is an amazing career. I can't believe you get paid to do this. After the first day, I was hooked.
Because you're an outdoors guy, really, at your core, is that it?
I've been climbing trees since I was three. My parents have pictures of me in the backyard in San Francisco in our plum tree at four. I climbed a Norfolk Island pine when I was six, up probably 50 feet. I was over the roof of the house. Mom couldn't find me.
Did you ever fall off a tree?
Not all the way.
Okay.
No, we have ropes. Actually, I was thinking about the surprising things people might not think about or consider when they think about tree workers.
Yeah.
The ladder is probably the most dangerous tool in our industry.
Because it can tip over. And if you're on a rope, it's like you're being harnessed.
Exactly. And, yeah. Once you get up in a big tree, you're tied in and you know how to tie your knots correctly. You have two points of attachment. You've got a big rope that we take up to the top of the tree. And that's our main climb line. And then you have a smaller flip line that's attached to your harness. And that's only a few feet long. That goes around the branch or trunk immediately in front of you. So if one of those should fail, the other one will catch you. So you always have these redundancies. But once you get that rope set in the tree and you've tied the knot securely and you know that you're safe, it becomes like an extension of you. You can use it to actually jump into another tree, swing through the tree, lean all of your weight on it, walk all the way out to the tippy top of a little skinny branch and not break it. It's an art to rope work.
I'm going to ask you what's hard about it later because that's not the hard part, but I still want to understand this transition that you made. How the hell did you really, you know, you held the rope. Did that start a career? Where did you go from holding a rope? What did you do next?
Yeah, he literally taught me the ropes and I just dragged brush.
I thought we weren't going to do puns.
Yeah, I'm over it. I'm sorry. It was at McAteer High School. Yeah, we were on Portola and so I was very familiar. It was kind of my neighborhood. I grew up around there. And the arborist was amazing. He ended up being one of my best friends. He was in my wedding. We're still friends to this day. Marty Arnest, I love him. He's like a brother. I worked for him for 8 years. But it was that first day that I thought, you can get paid to climb trees and make them pretty and healthy. And it just seemed like such a unique opportunity. I thought, well, I can always write. Soccer's never going anywhere. So I'm 22 years old. You know, I'd had a corporate job for a year.
You said that the guy was an amazing arborist. What made him amazing?
his thoughtfulness, his intelligence, really the way that he interacted with everybody, with myself and with the clients, and the way that he understood trees. It really was a second nature, and still is. He's retiring now. He's phasing out of it, but he's still active and still climbing trees. I won't say his age, but he's a good deal older than me. I'm 41. Mm-hmm. And there are people that still climb trees well into their 50s, 60s, even early 70s.
I see, really. I always thought you'd kill your knees or your back or whatever, so that's not true.
Well, stretch, eat well, take care of yourself. Yeah. And some people have a natural predisposition just towards hard work.
You know, everybody in every field being able to work well with the customers is darn important, if you're at all customer-facing. But you said you also knew a lot about trees. Give me an example of what a subtlety, some little fine point about expertise in trees that an amazing arborist would have that the average one wouldn't.
Yeah, when it gets down to it, you can only work with a tree to the extent that it will allow you to work with it. You can't force a single leader Christmas tree looking pine tree to be a low, flat, spreading sure. type of cypress tree. So there is an ability to read the tree, and I've always looked at it as sort of a natural crossword puzzle, and that's how I started working with Marty, was looking at each tree every day as its own little puzzle, and you had to figure out the best ways to take care of it, to make it healthy, structurally sound, strong, and secure, and safe. And once you started making a few cuts, the rest would tend to fall into place, just like a crossword puzzle. And they're nature's little puzzles.
But these puzzles, how much is the individual tree? And how much, I mean, I can open a Sunset Garden book and read all kinds of information about, you know, different trees. How much is the generic information about the tree for zone 16 or 17 that we're in here, Sunset Zone, and how much of it is a function of reading, as you were saying, the individual tree?
Yeah, it's more about learning on the job than reading books. The books definitely help, and I still refer to different online publications or my own library when I have questions about certain trees, whether it's X-current or D-current. You know, is there a single leader? Is it branching out? When you asked what made a good arborist, what distinguishes a good arborist from an exceptional arborist, there's almost an innate understanding of how a tree is going to grow. So you're not cutting it inappropriately and forcing it to be something that it's not. And then beyond that is being able to explain that to a customer who doesn't care. They don't know about the tree. They know that it's in their view. Right. Or they know that it's blocking their light. Right. So they just want it changed. And you can't always do that. And there's a subtlety in the way that you can explain that to people. And sometimes they won't hire you. You know, they just want somebody that's going to come in and just follow this line and cut it. And I'd do it myself if I had a rope. You know, good luck to you. I hope you have insurance. But a good arborist finds that balance. And it's sort of that fine line between the science and the art. Because at the end of the day, you want the tree to grow in the best way possible. You also want it to look as good as possible. And ideally, excellent tree pruning, you can't even really tell the tree's been pruned.
Let's talk about a specific tree. And by the way, that's right. I think that's the way with sound systems also. The best sound systems in a theater or whatever are those where you can't even tell it's amplified.
Exactly.
And it sounds like the same thing with the tree. The
subtle nuance.
Let's get specific. Let's take a specific tree that's awesome in San Francisco. And we're going to talk about that tree. Pick up what's a variety of tree you think is generally awesome as a street tree. Let's say a street tree in front of your house or a lawn tree, whatever you feel like talking about.
A particular tree in San Francisco that does well?
Yeah.
A quick backdrop to that, as people may or may not know, there were no trees in San Francisco. So originally this was just sandy grass dunes.
Wow.
Oakland with all the oak trees, fabulous. Mm. You get up into the redwood groves up north, that's wonderful. Our climate does not support trees, so we don't even really adhere to those sunset zones. If we're in zone 7, zone 9, 17, there are so many microclimates in San Francisco that a Japanese maple that looks amazing in front of your neighbor's house, and you want the same kind of thing, and you put it on an exposed location in front of your house, well, guess what? You get different sun, you get different wind. Mm-hmm. That thing's going to fry to a crisp and probably not last 3 years. So in terms of
just take one tree to talk about, you know, that you know a lot about. I want to get us a window into what it's really like to be an arborist. So
sure.
Let's talk about a tree. Let's say, talk about
Sequoia sempervirens, redwood tree.
Okay, well that's
my favorite.
Yeah, well that's great. That's a 150-foot tree that grows in your woods. That's not going to go in my front lawn.
It is also a fabulous tree in Noe Valley. We have a lot of those trees that do really well, especially in these little riparian areas. We have these underground creeks and streams, and they can latch into that water source, and they're sheltered from the wind. The one thing the redwoods can't stand is the wind. So you'll often look at the top of them and how they've been wind sheared at an angle, and that windward side is crisped and the lee side is just green and full and luscious.
I'm going to ask for another, because I know that there are relatively few people who have the money to have a huge estate where they can have a sequoia or a home. Let's say your average person who's got a small home in the Sunset or whatever, and they want to put a tree in their 4-foot cutout in the concrete, or maybe they have a little lawn with you or whatever.
Yep.
Let's talk about one of those kind of trees.
Okay. That perfect example there for, I think, one of the best suited trees to San Francisco would be the small leaf Tristania, or what some people call a swamp myrtle.
Tristania box, right? Is that what that is? Tristania box tree? Is that what that is?
The Brisbane box. It's a close type of tree, but they're not the same genus.
Okay. Paint a picture. What does it look like? And then let's tell me about the subtleties of where you should plant it, why you should plant it, what you as an arborist would do to make the most of that Tristania.
Well, I'll tell you why I picked it, because it's ubiquitous and it does well here, and because it's not messy. It's evergreen, so it doesn't get a lot of showy flowers. It doesn't get a lot of fruit. It doesn't get any fruit.
That's what messy means, dropping fruit.
It doesn't drop its leaves. You know, there's deciduous trees, and most of the showy ones that have flowers, they're barren in the winter. And I get a lot of upset people, neighbors really, who don't like all the leaves blowing into their gutters or their driveways.
Interesting. So they drop leaves, but only a little bit at a time, so there's no leaf mess.
Exactly. There's no mass accumulation, and they also don't seem to be disrupting the sidewalks very much.
Okay.
Most of the trees that do well in San Francisco are ones that have historically done well in Melbourne, Australia. Uh-huh. So about 18 of the most popular 25 planted street trees in San Francisco came from Melbourne or that area in southeastern Australia.
That's why they call it a Brisbane box, because Brisbane, Australia.
Exactly. Yeah. We take a lot of their trees. And this one seems to be particularly well suited to our climate. And it's very disease and insect tolerant. They grow fairly quickly, but not too large. And I hope to get back to the redwood in a minute, because one thing I wanted to say was you can keep any tree any size you want.
Interesting.
If you prune it regularly and well. So think of bonsai. There's 3-foot tall pine trees that are 300 years old.
Okay.
I have clients with redwood trees that are 40 years old and 15 feet tall.
So as an arborist, let's take, you know, what would you do? I'm trying to get a window into this, what it's really to be an arborist. What would you do with a Tristania if you showed up there? Let's say they've got one there, or you've got a sempervirens sequoia there. Teach me, get me into this arborist thing.
First thing that we do is we look at the structure. And there's a famous old quote, you look for the 4 Ds. You've got your dead, diseased, dying, and downright ugly. Those are the branches you take out first,
right.
And the rest tends to fall into place. So what you want to have is a more or less open ladder-like structure. In San Francisco, we have regulations over how high they have to be above the street and the sidewalk. So eventually, when a tree can support it, you take off those lower limbs, and we call those the scaffold limbs, and the main primary limbs is the structure of the tree. Beyond that, any of the little branches coming off of those that are growing back into the canopy, into each other, crossing, we eliminate those immediately, because crossing branches will rub wounds into the bark and open up vectors for insect or disease problems.
Okay. I want to talk about the career and how you can actually make a middle-class living, but I want to let our listeners know you're listening to Work with Marty Nemker here on KALW San Francisco, and I am talking with Scott Wheeler. He is an arborist. That's a tree guy. He also manages other tree guys for a small company called The Urban Arborist right here in the city. So, yeah, I want to turn to this. I got to be honest with you. I'm a worrier by nature. That's why I lost my hair. You know, I worry that the big tree companies like Davy Tree are creaming off the lucrative jobs, and then there's low barriers to entry into low-level tree work, which is going to drive the pay down. And if I get into this, by the time I build up enough skills and a reputation to get enough clients and money to buy trucks and chippers and all the rest of this stuff, you know, I'm going to either probably hurt my back or my legs. I'll need to change careers. Am I just being a worrywart?
Absolutely, and unnecessarily.
Tell me.
100%. We really do have a need for the larger commercial tree companies. Davy's a good one. Bartlett, Asplund. A lot of what they do is corridor trees along the main thoroughfares. They do a lot of just basic regulation, clearance, and maintenance. But San Franciscans are a discerning people, and they tend to want to know the people that are working on their homes, because a lot of us do worry about the trees around us or the windows rattling or the roof leaking. And you want to make sure that you get good work done and that you can trust the people who are working on your home and on your property. That's where the smaller tree companies really come in. And just to put a plug for the little guy, there's more than enough work to go around. There's over 400,000 trees in San Francisco, 125,000 just on the sidewalks.
Got it. Let me be very specific. I'm your brother. Let's pretend I'm your brother. And I also know there's a lot of guys who are doing tree work who are making $15 an hour or whatever, and that ain't sustainable, and they're probably not getting benefits and, you know, whatever. Let's say I like the idea of I like being on trees. I climbed trees as a kid. I maybe someone have a little bit of a horticultural interest as well. I don't want to be sitting in an office, but I need to make a middle-class living. San Francisco's crazy expensive. So what can I do if I'm starting out? What advice? I'm your brother. What's the advice you give to me as to how I have a reasonable shot, no guarantees, of making a middle-class living as an arborist, as a tree guy?
In San Francisco.
Yes.
Or
you could tell me to move to Iowa or whatever.
I would put my arm around my brother and tell him there's a great life for him in Ames. Go to Peoria.
Wait a minute. You told me there were 400,000 trees or whatever that needed attention in San Francisco. What do you mean?
Yeah. So
why do I have to go to Ames? It's a very nice place, but I'm not so crazy about going to the winters.
Well, if you want to start off as a tree worker in San Francisco, you need 3 years ground experience before you can even get insured to climb trees.
Wow.
So you take those 3 years as your Daniel-san, Mr. Miyagi moments, and you learn your quiet, you just do what you're told,
wow,
and you pay attention, you ask questions,
wow,
and then you'll start to learn how to prune small trees. We don't climb every
wow
tree.
3 years at minimum wage before I can even get insured.
Mm-hmm. Well,
keep
usually
going.
People in the industry probably start around 15 or 18 an hour,
yeah,
if you're lucky.
Right, exactly.
90% of us probably don't live in San Francisco. I don't live in San Francisco anymore. The reality is that it's too expensive for most people in these, you know, kind of menial type jobs to really
absolutely
form a middle class wage.
Absolutely.
And earn that living. So when I got started, I worked in restaurants and nightclubs, nights and weekends.
Wow.
I did trees during the day. And then I went and I was a host. I was a server. Worked at Beach Malika Babylon for 2 or 3 years. And this is after pruning trees during the day. So if you really want to do it, you can make it work, but it takes a lot
that's
of work.
That's too big. My first reaction is I can picture many of our listeners saying, that's just too much.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm not willing to pay those dues, and I'm willing to move. I mean, do I have to move all the way to Ames, Iowa, or can I be, you know, you say Oakland is a land of trees, Oakland.
Yeah.
You mean, are there places in the either near Bay Area or greater Bay Area where the, forgive the pun, the pickings are good?
Sure. I would say San Rafael, Concord. Even down the peninsula, San Mateo, San Bruno, that's where most of the people that I've worked with in the past have lived and come from and commuted into the city. We generally start work around 7 a.m., so the traffic's not too bad.
But let's say I live – all right, so I'm willing to live in Concord. It's not so bad. The prices are cheaper there. And you say there's a lot of work there, right? So now I'm back – I'm your brother, and I'm saying, okay, dude, I'm not going to Ames, but I'm willing to go to, you know, to Concord. And now I need your guidance as to how to end up making a middle class living. Should I try to be a consultant? Should I try to start a business? Should I work for a big company? What should I do? I don't need to get rich, but I want to make a sustainable living in the outdoors.
Yeah. Well, you have to consider, and I this may not be fascinating and it may just seem cliched, but as your brother, I have to be honest.
That's it.
You have to consider why you're really doing this. Why do you want this occupation? Is it because you love this and you're fascinated by it and you want to
like
learn as much as you can? Or you just want something that's going to make money and pay the bills?
No, I like it.
It's
I don't love it.
It.
You know, love it. I like watching Netflix. I like going out to eat. Am I going to love being on a tree every day? No. But I would like it better than sitting in an office all day with a boss driving me to make my number.
That's all it comes down to is what side of the glass do you want to be on? And I had a corporate job for 13 months, and I was looking down on Market and Montgomery Street on trees on tops of buildings and thinking, I'm on the wrong side of the glass. And so I made a big change. I would say that if somebody were really interested in getting into this line of work and wanted to make an honest go at it, The best thing to do is probably enroll in community college.
Okay. Where? Is it the Merritt College? I know has a horticulture program.
They're fabulous. I've taken classes there.
Exactly.
And seminars. City College has a fantastic horticultural program. And my mom was actually, she got started as a florist at City College.
Okay.
Those are great resources. There's also a library card, and there's the internet, and you can learn a ton about trees just to get yourself a little bit up to speed.
I do think book
enough to
can
jump
help.
Into a company, and then if you really were into it and wanted to go to a full-time college, get your degree in horticulture or dendrology, arboriculture.
Dendrology. I thought that was like dendrites, like within your brain, the thing. And what is dendrology?
The study of trees.
Really?
Absolutely. And arboriculture is the care of trees under dendrology.
I see.
But, you know, I had a friend who went to North Carolina, and he took a class in dendrology, and he memorized 500 different species of trees that I'll never know.
Wow.
But you can segue that into a management position. But the problem with that is that the people who are working for you know that you've never climbed, and you've never really put the time in the sweat in the trenches. Mm-hmm. So you can go out there and tell them to do things all day, but you're not going to really command that respect. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've run into in a lot of the bigger commercial tree companies.
I want to go to the phone and take a couple of calls, but I want one more point. So now, let's say I do that. Let's say I go to City College or Merritt College and I take a couple of courses in dendrology, and now I'm not willing to spend 3 years, but I'm willing to spend 6 months climbing. But I need to make a middle class living. What do you tell me to do?
Find a restaurant that you like on the weekends, because you're not going to do it.
Really?
I don't think it's going to happen.
Even in Concord?
Yeah.
Ames, I'd have to...
Possibly. The thing about the East Bay, and especially Oakland, Berkeley, is there are a plethora of fantastic aesthetic arborists and pruners that don't climb. One of the best arborists I ever saw, he taught a class actually in Japanese maple pruning at Merritt, Dennis Makashima, and he retired at 70-something, and he was... at the end, not pruning trees taller than the ladder that he could climb. And at the end of an 8-hour day, he would have a little tarp full of leaves.
So like large-scale bonsai.
Exactly.
Right.
And incredible. Gorgeous work. And you could work for somebody like that, and they could really teach you a lot and introduce you into the industry, and then maybe you can start your own business.
Well, there we go. So that makes more sense to me. What if I said I want to find a niche? Whatever it is, I'm going to be a citrus guy, or I'm going to be a crepe myrtle expert, or I'm going to be a Japanese maple guy, some esoteric, wonderful, gorgeous trees, you know, that maybe grow out of the area. You know, there are trees that grow in Southern California, you know, like plumerias and, you know, et cetera. What if I become a specialist in some niche like that and specialize in helping people grow trees out of the normal expected area?
That's possible. I know people that have specialized in just fruit trees.
Right.
And there's a lot of folks in San Francisco and the Bay Area that have these urban orchards, I call them, where they just have these amazing array of different types of plums and apples and peach. And
I happen to know that pomology is a major that they teach at UC Davis, and they have a world-famous program in pomology, which is fruits and stuff. Anyway, let's go to the phones. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko here on KALW, and my guest is Scott Wheeler. He is an arborist. He spends his life up on trees and managing others who do that as well. Well, the company he works for is called The Urban Arborist right here in San Francisco. If you've got a question or a comment for Scott about what it's really like to be an arborist, I don't want to hear your horticulture question about how often do I need to water my citrus. But if you got a question about the career, this is the time to call. The phone number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, while I wasn't going to... take calls about, you know, horticulture, you did beg me in our pre-interview. You said, I need to tell people one thing about planting trees. Go for it.
The most important part of a tree's life is the first 2 to 3 years when it's first in the ground. And we run into so many problems with mature trees that stem literally from poor plantings. And what a lot of people tend to do is take it right out of the pot and stick it right into the ground. You have to cut the roots. You have to open it up. You have to make sure the hole's big enough. And you have to make sure that you've mixed in the soil it's familiar with the new soil. Mm. And you have to water it in 20 gallons once a week for the first year or two at least. It's like having a kid. The better a foundation you started off with, the less headaches it's going to give you further on down the road.
You said a lot of great content, so I'm going to ask you actually to say it again a little more slowly so people can process it.
Instead of taking a tree right out of the bag and into the ground, cut the roots, open it up, really get in there, rip it up with a knife, be mean, be brutal, those roots need to spread. If it comes out of a pot where the roots have been girdling, circling around and around for its whole life, and you stick it like that into the ground, guess what? It's going to keep circling around and around, and it's going to get too big. It's going to get too heavy. The roots never spread out. Down she goes. So you get those roots ripped open. You get them opened up. They find that new nice soil that they like. They get a lot of good water. You don't water a little bit every single day. You water a lot once a week. And that water drains down, the roots chase it down, and it establishes anchorage.
The one thing you didn't say in the repeat that I want to stress, it's usually smart to mix the native soil around there with amendments like redwood compost and stuff like that, or other compost. Is that accurate?
Well, more or less. What's really important is that the soil that it came from in the nursery gets incorporated into the new soil in your garden.
I see.
So that there's a transitional layer.
Okay.
And if you have hard clay soil, use the edge of a shovel or a pick and score the edges of the hole to make ridges, and that'll get little tendrily roots, little places to dig into and hold on to, so they're not going to hit this hard barrier all of a sudden and take a U-turn.
That's a great tip. I hadn't thought of that. Instead of having to dig and dig and dig that horrible clay, I just score it a little bit so I create some little pockets
right
for
around the outside, the edges of the hole, all the way down so that they can root and anchor and get in there.
Great point. We got lots of calls, so let's go to the phones. Welcome. Now, in order for you to hear them, you got to plug that in underneath. If you look underneath, you'll see a receptacle right on the edge under the... There you go. And now, welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with arborist Scott Wheeler. What is your question or comment for him? Hi, it's you. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My name's Elizabeth, and I'm calling because my husband is actually really starting to look into getting an arborist certification. So I was wondering if Scott could share his thoughts on... that process and how important that is in kind of pursuing arborist work.
Great question. Both whether it's worth doing and which certifications for what purposes.
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling about that. Just quickly, does he have any background in the industry or outdoor work?
Yes, he does. He's done years of it out of state up in Idaho, so large scale, pines and that, but also in the city as well. So he has dealt with kind of smaller trees.
Oh, nice. Yeah, one thing that that I was told and I found to be true is that some of the best arborists aren't certified, and some certified arborists have no idea what they're talking about.
Academic training so often is very far removed from the real world.
Yeah, you can read all the books and take all the tests, pass all the exams, and get that certification, then get thrown out in the field and realize that you don't really know what you're doing in a hands-on environment. If he is serious about it, the ISA, which is the International Society of Arboriculture, they're sort of our parent organization, and they handle all of the licensing and certification for arborists. They have a lot of online info, and there's a wonderful guidebook to the certification process. Your husband can pick it up online for $60. You read through the guidebook. It's broken up into chapters. There's a little quiz at the end of each chapter. You read through that, and if you know anything about trees going into it, he just has to apply to take the test, and I guarantee you he'll be certified.
That is a great call. I appreciate it, and a great answer. Thank you very much for the call. Let's take one more call, because we are running out of time. Welcome to Work with... Oh, they hung up. Okay. So I'm going to just ask you the kind of a softball question. Is there one thing that we haven't talked about yet regarding what it's really like to be an arborist that might either surprise us, be interesting to our listeners? Softball, open-ended question.
Yeah, great. I can only speak for being an arborist in San Francisco. It's the only place that I've worked in tree care. I've been doing it for 17 years, and every day there's a surprise. I've climbed trees and put my hand up into a crotch.
Watch that.
a union of trunks, and found a hypodermic needle. 15 feet up in a tree where you don't expect to put your hand on a hypodermic needle.
That's true. I can try to picture that. Somebody trying to get high. I guess they wanted real privacy. I guess that was one way
really
to do it.
They really wanted to get high.
A
Snapple bottle on the end of a branch that was 15 feet above a building. Somebody must have put it on years ago, and a tip probably at a party off of a fire escape, and it just grew up and up and up and up until I met it and took it out.
An Apple, what? Say that.
A Snapple bottle.
Oh, a Snapple bottle.
A little glass juice bottle.
Of course.
But the one thing that rings true for me in San Francisco, more than most other places you can do this, is that if you can do tree work in this city, you can do it anywhere. Because the houses are all together, the entrances are all narrow, the backyards are steep, there are big trees covering six properties, everybody loves their garden, and you can't damage a neighbor's plant, you can't damage a fence, you've got glass roofs, you've got skylights, you've got everything you can think of possibly in the way of obstacles underneath you. And then you have to get all that brush out into the street. And where are you going to park the truck in the street? And how are you going to drive a big truck with a chipper through these windy little streets and these steep hills? I know people that have worked in Idaho and Vermont and done logging in Oregon, and they've come here and lasted 6 months maybe, because we don't have those open spaces. And you really have to learn how to manage the people end of it beyond just the trees. It's not just we're out there hugging trees and loving them all day. I wish that were the case. More often than not, I'm looking at my windshield or I'm looking at my computer screen. The best part of my job, frankly, is the people. I get to meet every kind of person imaginable, and I get invited into homes and gardens all over town in the Bay Area, which is a privilege and an honor. But it does come as a cost. You have angry neighbors and you have people that want that tree out of their view, and you have people. I've had a guy try to pull me off a ladder because he thought I was murdering a tree.
Wow.
And just pruning it. You know, you can't touch it because I can hear the tree screaming.
Yeah. Well, you murdered this interview. You did a great job.
Thanks, Mario. Anyway, following your lead.
Yeah, Scott Wheeler, who is, again, he is a principal, I guess that's the right word to quite describe, a principal, a manager, an arborist, a tree climbing, tree hugging, people liking guy at Urban Arborist, and the website is urbanarboristsf.com. urbanarboristsf.com. Thanks. All right, we'll take one more call. We are listener first here at Democratic KELW. Let's take one more call. Okay, welcome to the show. What is your question or comment for Scott Wheeler?
Hi, guys. I was listening to the part where you were talking about maybe apprenticing under a master of some kind and learning the ropes that way instead of going through school. And I just want to say, I've worked in industries where I'm surrounded by self-taught masters, and they're always looking for somebody to start working for them. But not all of them are always the best teachers to actually get you up and running to a place where you can do it yourself. Mm-hmm. So, for the both of you, like, what sort of tips could you recommend to, like, be able to, I don't know, carefully choose who you work under so you don't end up wasting a couple of years of minimum wage employment?
That is a fantastic question, and it applies so broadly, well beyond arboriculture. The answer is in the vetting process. You know, if we're a job seeker, we tend to be desperate, and we're just so worried about how we're coming across. It is like a first date. You are both checking each other out, and that gives you the right to ask questions. Like, can you give me a little idea of how much, I know you're very busy, I want to get a sense of how much mentorship I can really count on. Or tell me a little bit about, you know, as you see a tree, as you see a Tristania tree, you know, or a Sequoia sempervirens, what goes through your head? That gives you a sense of how expert they really are. Are they really a chop shop, or are they somebody who's esoteric? And that will help you. And you also get a sense of how enthusiastic they're about mentoring. Sometimes people, when they're in there, they're hungry. They're in their 20s and 30s and 40s. They're trying to make money. They're not so interested in mentoring. But as people enter their 50s or 60s, they are aware that their time in their profession may be ending, and they want to pass the mantle to the next generation, and therefore may be psychologically more motivated to be a mentor. Scott Wheeler, to what extent is that applicable to arboriculture?
No, 100%. Yeah, that applies completely. And there are a lot of people that are just really hard to work with and hard to learn from, especially in this industry. People have been doing this a long time and accumulated a wealth of knowledge, don't always want to share that knowledge. And they don't want to just share it lightly and give it away blithely. They want to make sure that you're actually committed to it and that you're a worthy apprentice. So it takes a certain level of sacrifice on that end.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I know many people. I know a guy who runs a marine repair business. They repair outboard motors and things like that. And for years, he trained people and gave so much of himself. And what happened would be the person would get 2 weeks of training or a month, say, I can do this myself. And after all that effort, would run away. So one of the things you do need to convey, yes, you need to vet them, but you need to say, you know what? I am going to treat with great respect the time you're going to have given me to mentor me. And I'm not going to run off and start my own business. I'm interested in being a great employee. As long as you treat me well, I will treat you well. Is that an important thing to do, Scott?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say if you're on time, you're late. If you're 5 minutes early, you're on time. You have to show these people the respect that they deserve, that they've earned for years. Because in our industry in particular, it costs a lot to train people. Exactly. You know, we've got to get you on the insurance. We've got to get you on workers' comp. You know, there's healthcare to think about, and then all the equipment that comes with it, the specialized training, chipper workshops, chainsaw workshops. It's an investment on our end, too. And we don't want to spend that much time and, frankly, the resources on somebody if they're not committed and they're just going to take it and maybe go somewhere else or do something else entirely.
Exactly. Caller, it was a great call again. Thank you very much for the call, Joanne. Thank you for encouraging me to take that other call. And so, Scott Wheeler again. Thanks very much from Urban Arborist. Thanks very much for being guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. It was a pleasure.
Great. And now we turn to you. You know, I imagine most of you have no interest whatsoever in being an arborist, but you've got a career problem of some sort. So I invite you to call if you are self-employed, employed by a nonprofit, for-profit, small company, large company, happily employed but still have a problem, or unemployed and scared to death. All kinds of work-related problems are fair game. I love to help you solve a problem. I'm completing my 29th year here at Work with Marty Nemko, and I'm as excited as you can tell in my voice. I'm as enthusiastic about helping you today as I was when I started. So, give me a chance to help you. The price is certainly right. This is my pro bono work. I do it because I care. And I'm grateful to KELW for the privilege of doing the show. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, if you want a, what I call a workover with no pummeling involved, usually, the phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, I want to, you know, everyone wants to be smarter. And advertisers know it. So many items are branded smart. Like smartphone or smart homes or the smart car, you know, those little cars, or smart growth cities. UPS offers smart pickup. Even psychology has jumped on board. There's a national chain of substance abuse groups called, you guessed it, Smart Recovery. Well, defining smart may be a bit like the way Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart defined pornography. I know it when I see it. But for purposes of this little talk, this little monologue, I'm going to define smart as the ability to, with above average speed and depth, the ability to learn difficult things and solve problems. But that's no mean feat to become smarter. Intelligence, at least as they measure on intelligence tests, is notoriously resistant to improvement. For example, the definitive studies of Head Start, whose original purpose was to raise cognitive functioning, now, 55 years after its inception, has been unable to produce enduring gains. I saw a very discouraging review of 90 separate evaluations of Head Start in U.S. News. It's called, the headline was, Scant Scientific Evidence for Head Start Program's Effectiveness. But logically, at least, it would seem that doing the following could make you appear more intelligent, if not actually become smarter, which, of course, even appearing more intelligent can be inordinately helpful in your work life. So I want to start with talking about some very specific things related to work, and then I'm going to go more broadly to ways to seem more intelligent in your life overall. So it's so tempting to switch into a new field. Novelty is fun. But you're going to appear more intelligent and likely create better work products if you leverage what you know. So when you think about wanting that career change, realize it's going to be harder to appear intelligent if you do. Try to somehow do a minor pivot rather than a radical change. You will appear smarter. Another way in which you can adjust your work life to appear smarter is to take on supervisory and mentoring work. That appears to require a high level of intelligence. But supervisors and mentors often can be effective mainly by being supportive, listening, helping to get resources and such. So that can often be a way to appear smarter. I'll tell one more. I'm going to go to the phones, and then I'll have much more to say about this. But another way to appear smarter in your work life is to facilitate groups. If you, say, moderate a panel at a professional meeting, or with a group of colleagues in your field. That can convey intelligence without unduly taxing your brain power. Again, caring and listening and asking good questions can go an awful long way. I've got many more tips for seeming smarter, but I want to prioritize you, my dear listeners. So before I go to the phones, I'll give out the phone number again. If you want to work over, you got any work-related problem, I'm happy to help. The phone number here at KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, is that me?
Yeah, it is indeed.
Oh, hi. Hi. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I have spoken to you about work stuff before, but now I have a different situation. What happens when somebody is in an accident and is suddenly gone from work, and just some of the legal stuff around communicating with the coworkers? So I'm a nurse in a community health setting, and I was in a bike accident 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to be laid up for some weeks. So, but I was concerned about a few of my patients who,
of course.
You know, I wanted to give, like, warm handoffs, but I got the message from my supervisor and his boss that I wasn't supposed to be doing any work from home. But it seems like if you've had an unplanned absence, you know, that you kind of want to just make sure that patients are going to fall through the cracks.
What's the reasoning? What is the boss's reasoning behind? You're not asking to get paid.
It's a liability or something. Ugh. I don't know. Nobody has explained really the reasoning, but they say I basically cannot communicate with my fellow, like the case managers, and I'm the only nurse there, and I work with several case managers, and like they must be forbidden to communicate with me because I don't get.
Jeez.
I don't hear anything, you know.
This scares me a lot. I mean, to think, you know, the liability, actually, if I was the boss, I think the liability would be greater if there wasn't a good handoff to the new nurse. Patient dies. Now you've got both liability and, of course, you've got the human cost. If it were me, I wouldn't quite accept that. Let me finish. I would talk with your boss and I would say, is there a way consistent with minimizing your liability that this crucial information with a certain few patients gets conveyed either from me to you and you can pass it on to the person? I'm not asking to work full time. If we could spend a few minutes chatting about these few patients, there's probably only a few major things that need to be told. 5 minutes on the phone might reach a point of diminishing returns in terms of, you know, any kind of liability increase, but would help those patients. What do you think?
Well, I kind of already did that, but the thing is, like, I guess I just kind of wanted to hear, you know, that somebody got it, you know, and they're going to take it and run with it, you know, that it's taken care of. Because to hear nothing back,
I know,
you know.
I can only tell you, if you've already talked to them, I would put it in writing, both to protect you and the patient. And I might even raise the issue of liability if the handoff is not effective. Now, I'm sure there's patient records, but for my peace of mind and an ethical position, I would feel yucky. If the boss didn't want to talk to me, I would write a brief note with just a few bullet points about each of those few patients and say, you know, if you're precluded from showing this, I can't, but my caring about this patient's life and death or excess morbidity or whatever is just too great for me to just sit there. So I felt I need to do this. Shred it if you need to, but I feel I needed to do that. What do you think about doing that?
Yeah, I think I'm going to write one last email.
All right. In the end, there are rules, and, you know, I believe one of the signature, I was talking about being smarter or appearing smarter. One of the signature characteristics of intelligence is broad thinking. Not just saying, it's a rule, I have to follow it, there is not allowed. The wise person thinks in the largest perspective. You know, we all that bumper sticker, think globally, act locally. Thinking globally, I think even cosmically, you know, what is the greatest good that accrues here? Think of the guilt that you would feel if the patient died. Think of the patient's dying. Think of the patient's family.
It's not exactly life or death, but
it's
like I have the paperwork for a procedure for somebody, you know, for the second week of September, and it's locked away in my office. And I don't want my sudden absence to be the reason that she doesn't get that procedure because it was a long time getting, you know, worked up for that.
Got it.
And it's supposed to lead to more surgery. And,
got it.
You know, I don't want to be the reason that she doesn't get what she should get.
I think all you can do then is send those in a document to your boss in writing. Just say, I didn't do any work. This was simply here. I just Xeroxed it and put it in the, you know, I scanned it to you. Just scan it. It takes 2 minutes. Scan whatever those documents, reiterate you have not done any work, etc. You're just forwarding the information, and he or she, your boss, he or she can do with it what he or she wants. At the end, you know, it's like the serenity prayer. You've got to know, you have the wisdom to know what you can and can't do. But you could, I think you could at least scan that. Does that make sense?
Well, I can't scan it because, first of all, I'm laid up, and I don't have the documents that are locked in my office.
Oh,
I'm not in my office.
Well, then give the summary. Just send a written email summary, whatever, email.
Yeah.
Just a written summary. You've done your part. That's all you can do. And at some point, we have to... There's, unfortunately, literally millions and millions of people who are starving and dying unnecessarily in different places around the earth. We can't do everything. We can only do what we... I'm sorry you got a bicycle accident. I hear about them all the time. We're all very aware of bicyclists, but... Even with the bike striping and whatever, it's easy to not see them. So I'm sorry you got into a bike accident.
Well,
take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And then...
Have you ever heard of an employee being cut off from their coworkers, Lexis?
Nope, I'm not. But that's out of my expertise.
Okay.
I'm not a lawyer nor an insurance expert. But I'm just trying to, in the end, try to rely on my common sense and what I've learned as a career counselor. So my best shot is to send a brief letter with an acknowledgement of not really asserting that you're not working and therefore not in violation of rules. You're just you're just forwarding a brief amount of key information.
Yeah.
That's my best shot.
Thank you, Marty. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. And I invite you to call Work with Marty Nemco if you've got a work-related problem, whether you're 16 or 76. The harder, the better. Like I said, I've been doing this for 29 years. So the harder the work problem, the better I like it. So feel free to call. The number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we were talking about ways to seem smarter in the workplace because it's hard to actually get smarter. And sometimes, you know, lest it be seen like I'm focusing merely on the veneer and not the substance, sometimes seeming smarter actually can rub off and actually make you smarter. And I'll give you some examples of that here. So, language is such an important way to appear intelligent or not. And one of the ways that you can do that and appear intelligent is to avoid taking all or nothing positions. The intelligent person realizes that there's almost always exceptions to black and white positions. So you're going to appear more intelligent if your statements are couched. For example, using terms such as usually, often, and most of me believes that. So, for example, we're a very political area here in the Bay Area. So if you lean liberal, you might say, for example, rather than, I believe progressive ways are the right way, say, you know, I believe that progressive principles tend to lead to a better society. But there probably are conservative perspectives worth considering. You're going to come off much more intelligent. Another easy, this is kind of a cheap way to seem more intelligent, is... vocabulary. Appropriately using a $10 word is a fast way to convey that you're bright. And indeed, vocabulary is a key part of most intelligence tests because it measures the ability to learn abstractions on the fly. When you learn a new word, you're having to infer a word's meaning from the context, and you have to remember it. So that combines memory and inferential and analysis. Those are important parts of intelligence. That said, it takes an awfully long time to improve your vocabulary through the day-to-day conversations and through reading. So I've created a 326-word list of words that are difficult but have frequent enough use in speaking or at least in writing. And I put it on Psychology Today, where I write all the time. You can find that list by simply Googling Beyond the GRE Words Quiz. Beyond the GRE Words Quiz. You might also enter the words from that list that you might, you know, maybe out of the 326, you want to learn 25 of them because you've heard them before and you'd like to be able to use them. You can enter those words into a great website called vocabulary.com. I think there's another one called quizlet.com, which will pleasantly test you on those words. I also assembled a list of 51 words and phrases that demonstrate the kind of nuanced analytical thinking that is emblematic of intelligent people. Here are a few examples. Probabilistic. Opportunity cost. Reasonably derived, you know, like that principle was reasonably derived from my experience climbing trees, kind of thing. So those are nuanced kind of phrases that simply will make you appear more intelligent, but by using them, you're going to be forced into actually thinking in a more nuanced way, right? You can find that list of those words by Googling Wise Words Nemco, because the article is called Wise Words, but there's a lot of, if you Google that, just Wise Words, you'll get many listings, but if you Google Wise Words and then Nemco, you'll get that list. It is at least as important to avoid language that makes many people perceive you as a dim bulb. I've also created a list of words and phrases and behaviors to avoid. For example, mispronouncing common words, like instead of saying the height of a tree, saying the height of a tree is going to not exactly brand you as the brightest tool in the shed. Saying, like George Bush did, nuclear instead of nuclear, similarly. You know how much fun people made of George Bush for not saying nuclear, but saying nuclear? Saying et cetera, as opposed to et cetera. Incorrectly saying irregardless instead of regardless. Jewelry instead of jewelry. Library instead of library. Duct tape instead of duct tape. It's not duct tape. It's duct, as in the tape was originally used to seal the ducts in an HVAC, in heating, venting, and air conditioning system. Or a more subtle example is, and this is particularly relevant to job seekers, so many job seekers start, or they're requesting an informational interview, and say, "My name is Joe Jones." That is a terrible way to start a letter. First, and it does not convey intelligence. First, it seems a bit narcissistic. Your name isn't of great interest. Worse, it's redundant because your name's going to appear at the end of the message, and if it's an email, it's going to be in the from line of the email, your name. So those are the kind of things you want to avoid, and I've created a list of that language to avoid, and again, the easiest way for you to find it is to Google Behaviors That Make You Seem Stupid. That was the name of the article I wrote. Behaviors That Make You Seem Stupid. All right, I'll give out the phone number one last time. We have calls on the line, but I want to give out the phone number one more time. Phone number here, Work with Marty and Nemco. If you want some help with your work life, I call them workovers. The phone number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. The call hung up, which gives me an opportunity to share some more of these tips. Oh, I guess the person's calling back. But I'll offer another tip or two about how to sound more intelligent before we go back to the phones. It's important to ask curiosity-driven questions. In conversation, really listen to what's being said. That can trigger questions you're curious to ask about, and that will make you seem more intelligent. One more. You want to tell your tried and trues. This is true in the workplace, whether it be a wine and cheese, you know, social thing that the workplace puts on, or outside of work. Over your lifetime, you may have developed some well-honed anecdotes and arguments and riffs on some topic or other. List your favorites. Have this little list. Put it in your wallet, in your purse, and consult that list before attending social gatherings. So at the right time, you can trot one of those out. That needn't be limited to conversation. So you might give talks, for example, at a professional conference, or a meeting or a hobbyist organization. You'll have plenty of time to assemble and organize plenty of smart thoughts if you're writing, if you're listing those well-honed anecdotes. That's going to make you seem smart without having to be a genius. And if you're giving a talk, you can have note cards in front of you so you don't even have to remember anything, yet again, placing less tax on your intelligence, making you seem more intelligent. Anyway, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hello.
Hi, Marty. I'm a student, so this isn't technically about work, but it will relate to my future
Fine.
Work.
Great.
Great. So I'm getting my master's degree in occupational therapy, and I have a choice right now whether to do my field work. There's actually two field work placements, so I'm getting placed for my second one, and I have a choice to do it either at an acute care hospital setting, which may be high stress, mm-hmm. a longer commute. Mm-hmm. I might have to relocate and spend mm-hmm. more money, whereas right wow. now I have a great living situation. Yeah. Or to do it at a skilled nursing facility, which is like a nursing home.
Mm.
Which I'm not sure yet, but I think that the acute care hospital setting might lead to a broader range of future work possibilities.
You know, I think one of the big mistakes that young people make is they want to keep all their options open, and they become a jack of all trades, master of none, and they uh-huh. hide what they're best suited for. If there was a goddess, would the goddess say you are better equipped as just by nature or your previous experiences or your passions? Are you more likely to work well in an acute care situation? You told me it would be very stressful, which made me think that's not the case. And
right.
Whereas you might be able, because there's less rushing very often in skilled nursing facility with older people, which would the goddess say you are wiser to choose?
Good question. I feel like in skilled nursing, there's a different type of rushing where they want you to have this certain percentages of what they call productivity. So sometimes they're so high that people end up not being able to meet them, and they have to end up staying late. So I guess I need to figure that out.
You know, one of the if it's a borderline decision, something that I talked earlier with Scott Wheeler about, the arborist, in response to one of the callers, what will matter more is the nature of the supervision you get, the nature of the mentoring.
Uh-huh.
So if is it all possible to chat with the person who would be your supervisor to get a flavor for how interested and capable that person is of mentoring you, that may be the tipper. Now, I am very daunted by the commute. I know it's nightmarish. It's so draining on a person, those long commutes. So that certainly, I don't want you to ignore that factor. But maybe if you factor in A, what the goddess would say, B, a little conversation with both supervisors, and then C, the commute, and then D, where you really think in the end, and that's part of what the goddess would say, would be addressing. Picture yourself, not for a lifetime, we don't necessarily stay in one field a lifetime, but picture next 5 years.
Yeah.
Picture your next 5 years in an acute care facility in a hospital, or picture the next 5 years in a skilled nursing place. But one thing I want to say, hospitals and skilled nursing places can both be subject to overwork requirements and not overwork requirements. That's going to be a function more of who the particular workplace. There may be a philosophy of reasonable work-life balance in some workplaces, whether it be skilled nursing or acute care. And in other places, they work until you drop. So that'll be when it comes time to look for a real job. In the course of your vetting them in the interview process, get a sense. Ask them about what the normal work expectation is. Go when you're offered the job. Talk to some people who are working there and say, is the work-life balance thing reasonable? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, and thank you for that. I will look into all those things. I think the main question for me right now is, and I've been interviewing other people who work in this field to ask their opinion, whether if I get the training at the hospital setting, would I be able to work in a hospital or a skilled nursing, whereas if I got the training in the skilled nursing, I may only be able to work in that setting, and maybe it's like a reduced,
reduced options, but that was the point I made earlier. Sometimes keeping all the options open makes you less choosy. I want you to make a choice of which really, I want you to do the hard thinking and the investigation to think about which really is going to be the right place, or at least a reasonably right place for you next time out. Make sense?
Yeah, thanks so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco. And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr. And also I want to give a thank you to Matt Martin. Matt Martin, he and I are kind of different people, and yet he's a very professional guy, and I wish him all the best. And I know he's got a lot of fans here at KALW for the 12 years of work that he's done. And, of course, I want to thank all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover, plus wearables at work. You know those adaptations of Apple Watches and Fitbits? There were some studies recently that found they can both improve productivity and, this was a little bit surprising, improve employee satisfaction. But is there a downside? Until then, next Thursday at 7, this is Marty Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.